Welcome back, Sandy Barua, sitting in for my good friend Paul W. Smith, wishing Paul and Kim a great R&R. Joining us right now, Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin. Congresswoman, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sandy. You're doing great. You're doing great subbing in for the greats.
I tell you, I'm hanging on to every hard surface I can possibly find, Congresswoman.
It's awesome.
So, Congressman, you have this amazing career in public service. After grad school, you joined the CIA. You're briefing Presidents Obama, President Bush. You did three tours in Iraq. What an amazing career. And you're still a very young person, as someone who's 60 years old would say. First of all, I just want to say thank you for your incredible public service to date.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, there's a lot of us in that sort of post-9/11 generation that came of age when the country was attacked who just decided to go into service of some kind. So I appreciate it. And thank you for saying it. It's nice.
Yeah, no, I remember I was sitting in my office at the Commerce Department looking out the window, and I couldn't figure out why there was a big plume of smoke coming out of what appeared to be, you know, actually looked like the Red Cross building, but it was actually the Pentagon across the river.
Yeah.
Then I realized a few minutes later what was happening. So for those of you who served in uniform, I just have the greatest amount of respect for. So,
well, I did not serve in uniform, just to clarify.
Yeah, that's
CIA
true.
Alongside the military.
Yes, your uniform was clandestine.
That's right.
So I want to start with, the national security outlook. Obviously, you and your opponent have these very deep histories in national security. You look around the globe. There is a lot to be concerned about, the geopolitical threat from China, you know, the Russian aggression against Ukraine and other places. Obviously, the Israel-Gaza conflict. As you put your intelligence hat on, how do you gauge the threats to America?
Yeah, you know, I think in contrast to when I kind of came of age in national security, the war on terror and, you know, concerns about being attacked again and again, you know, here and overseas, it's really back to, frankly, more traditional great power competition. You know, how is Russia going to disrupt world peace and the economy, and especially China? I mean, I think that's, and it's a complicated one because we all know that, you know, we buy things from China. A lot of our local companies are very enmeshed with China. But between the military competition, the economic competition, the cultural competition, they're cheating on the international system. I really think that China is the sort of medium to long-term threat and the one that if you're in national security, you need to be prepared for.
Are there bipartisan solutions regarding China in particular? As I listen to former President Trump in particular, I often get a little confused as to kind of where he is on China.
I mean, I think there's definitely, you know, for as messy as Congress can be and Washington can be, China is one of those places where actually there's a lot of agreement. We have a bipartisan China committee. We have in the Armed Services Committee a lot of overlap and bipartisan legislation. I think a lot of it has to do with making sure our military is prepared, not just for sort of with the hardware for the future, but the software, the technology that the Chinese have invested in, particularly in a place like space. There's a lot of kind of science fiction stuff going on, but, you know, we need to make sure that we're ready for those 21st century threats. And then there's a ton of agreement on pushing back economically. Now, I think sometimes there's a difference of style. I certainly don't think that a blanket, you know, 20% tariff on all foreign goods and a 60% tariff on Chinese goods that President Trump has suggested makes sense. So that's just going to end up with, you know, $2,000, $3,000 out of the hands of American consumers per year. I suggest a scalpel rather than a sledgehammer. But I think there's agreement on the problem set, and that's a good place to be, given how fraught Washington is.
You know, speaking of China and technology, electrification has been a theme of our time on the radio today. We're seeing this global move towards electrification, but we're seeing, frankly, the interest in EVs certainly slow down in North America. you know, how do, from a policy perspective, should we approach, you know, this kind of, you know, burgeoning trend of electrification with some of the reticence that we're seeing in buyers today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the history of the car companies is having to adjust based on consumer interest. You know, I think, you know, Mary Barra came to us from GM as members of Congress during the Trump administration and talked about her plans for electrification. This is something that they see around the world just booming. And, you know, obviously have to adjust to markets here. But I think the main thing is, no one's going to make you drive an EV, right? I don't drive an EV. I live on a farm. There's not really a possible way for me to drive an EV. But if you want to know, for me, who should make them, it should be Michigan, right? It should be the United States. And I don't want to miss the trends that are happening. You know, we missed, arguably, this idea that consumers would want these smaller fuel-efficient cars in the 70s and 80s. We've missed trends before. So I think the industry has to go for it and then has to make adjustments based on consumers. But I definitely want to build the next generation of cars in Michigan. I'm not going to cede that. And if you look in the European Union, where the Chinese automakers have 30% market share, in Mexico, 30% market share with those EVs, heavily subsidized EVs, I see that as a danger to the United States. That's why I spent a lot of time coming up with legislation to literally ban Chinese EVs from the United States, because I don't want to end up with them eating up our market share.
Well, I appreciate you referencing the lessons that we didn't learn in the 1970s with the threat from the Japanese and quality and fuel efficiency. So I appreciate you making that analogy. No pun intended, but I'm going to shift gears for a second here. And you got a wonderful day four speaking slot at the Democratic National Convention. We're just coming off of that. Tell us what it was like to be there. Obviously, the dynamics in the Democratic Party changed pretty dramatically in a short period of time.
Yeah, it's been, you know, you can't buy this kind of energy, manufacture this kind of energy. I think it was just pent up desire for change and for a different generation. So the messages for me coming out of my first convention, I'd never been to a convention before. 2020 was COVID, you know, and I just haven't been in that long. But the messages to me, which I tried to capture at least in part in my speech, is like, wear your patriotism on your sleeve. Be proud of your country and your role in fighting to make it a better place, no matter who you are and what your angle is. Like, you care about your country and we should be proud of that. And then number two, that we just have like a very broad base coalition in the Democratic Party. You know, I mean, there's nothing more diverse than putting up like a Bernie Sanders followed by a billionaire. You know what I mean? It shows you the breadth of differences in our party, which can sometimes be messy, but I think for the last, you know, week or so, we've really shown can also work together. And I thought that was an important message.
Well, some of those billionaires can be pretty liberal too, I'm just saying.
for sure. But I thought it was kind of trolling. I thought it was funny.
So we have less than 30 seconds left. You know, you've been, you know, working hard to be a bipartisan leader. What do you think's the one thing that, you know, needs to happen in Washington to continue some more bipartisan work?
I mean, I think people have to get to know each other as human beings, spend time together, just cool the rhetoric, not be so nasty, be able to join something like the Problem Solvers Caucus, which I'm in, equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans, get to know each other again, and just be better than our current politics is trying to force us to be.
Well, Congresswoman Slotkin, we thank you for your past and your continued public service. We want you to be very safe on the campaign trail. We know that's getting, unfortunately, a little bit more dangerous these days. So please be safe and keep in touch, and we thank you so much for calling in today.
Thanks, Andy. Have a good one.
All right. And we'll be back.